Okay, we'll get started again. So, what we're going to look at here is how we lay out cells and how we assign channels to cells in such a way as to achieve a specific, what we call, signal to interference ratio. So here we're comparing the power of our intended signal to the power from other received signals using the same channel. Okay. And as we've said, this type of design is reliant on the fact that a transmitted signal is decreasing proportional to some factor of distance. We'll just call that factor gamma for now. Okay. Now, we're going to assume that our system is very sort of uniform, so we can lay out our base stations regularly, and all of these base stations are going to transmit at the same power level. Okay. And that means that, again, the decrease, the characteristic decrease is going to be the same for all base stations. So here, if you have two base stations using the same channel, halfway in between is where they'll intersect. Okay. And so, again, we are going to have to reuse our channels, and so that means that for cells broadcasting on the same channels, there will be some interference, and we call that co-channel interference. But the question is about distances at which we reuse these channels. And so what we would like to think is that the sort of range of this base station is relatively limited, and so the interference from other base stations then is going to be relatively small. And so what we see roughly is that the interference, or the amount of interference, the relative amount of interference to the actual signal, is going to depend on the range of the base station relative to the overall, relative to the distance between two base stations using the same channel. We're going to look at two classes of systems. We'll spend most of the time looking at orthogonal systems. I had called it, I think in this slide, orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, but that refers to a very specific multiplexing technique. What I mean by orthogonal here is just that the frequency spectrum is broken up into individual channels, so unshared channels. Okay. And the contrasting technique then is a spread spectrum technique such as co-division multiple axis. Here, all of the frequencies are going to be used in all of the cells. And so you can see, think that you'll have slightly different interference, types of interference for the two systems. For orthogonal multisystems, the interference again comes from base stations that are set apart from each other, but at a far enough distance that they're reusing channels. With CDMA, well, every frequency is used in every cell, so you potentially get interference within the cell if your codes are not orthogonal, and you also get interference from adjacent cells, where again the same spectrum is in use. Okay. The goal is again to limit the interference from, not adjacent cells, but nearby cells using the same frequencies. Okay. And so the ratio that we're concerned with here is the signal interference ratio. And again, you need your signal strength to be at a certain level relative to interference. Okay. Now, the thing to think about is that you can't improve your signal interference ratio now by boosting your signal strength. Again, if we make this assumption that all of the base stations are transmitting at the same strength, so if you increase the amount, the power at which they're transmitting, then they've all increased, and therefore the interference has increased as well. The only way you can improve the signal-to-interference ratio is by keeping the base stations using the same channels farther and farther apart. Okay, so we're going to spend more time looking at our orthogonal systems. Here, again, we're assuming that our channels are unshared within a cell. Okay. And our basic requirement is that adjacent cells are not going to use the same channels. Okay. Reuse can occur at some greater level. So, it's quite common to see these hexagonal sort of honeycomb shape, and it's not, just to note, it's not the only shape possible, but it's frequently used, primarily because of its sort of geometric properties, in that when we form sort of groups of these cells, if we are clever about how we form these groups, we can repeat the groups over and over again. Okay. So our goal is to divide our coverage into non-overlapping cells, and again, assuming that we have this ideal antenna which is radiating circularly, sort of in 360 degrees, you can't completely have no overlap, but our cell pattern is going to be derived by sort of splitting the overlap in half. Okay. And what we want to do now is decide how we assign our channels to the cells to get to a reasonable level of reasonable signal interference ratio. Okay. Now, again, hexagons were considered to be, if you just had sort of green fields everywhere, hexagons were considered to be a nice shape. They have this property which is called tessellating, which means they can be arranged to cover the entire area with no overlap. And when you group them together, if you're clever about how you group them together, the groups can cover the area with no overlap. Okay. Another common pattern, which it would be more likely to be seen in urban areas, maybe not downtown Dublin, which doesn't believe in blocks, but in, say, the U.S., where cities are laid out on a grid system, would be diamond or square-shaped. And again, these have the same property of tessellation, where they will cover an area, and clusters of them can also be used to cover an area. Okay. Now, the size of an individual cell is going to have an impact on the power level at which a signal has to be transmitted. So the smaller the cell, the lower power at which a signal can be transmitted, which, again, for the mobile unit at least, is going to save on batteries. Note that you can't sort of drop the power level indefinitely, because at some point you run up against noise as well. So the signal has to be of sufficient strength to provide a good signal-to-noise ratio as well. Again, aside from noting that we have to have it sort of high enough, that's not going to be the concern today. The concern today is, again, the signal-to-interference ratio. Okay. Now, this statement actually isn't correct, since all cells are transmitting at the same power level. The point I made before is that since they're all transmitting at the same power level, what is going to reduce the signal to interference ratio is the relative distance apart they are. Okay, not actually the power level. So that statement is actually incorrect. Just make a note of that. Okay. So, in reality, again, we're not going to be able to get this nice regular layout of base stations. Even if we get a nice regular layout, terrain is going to lead to different dropouts in power in different places and sort of different interference in different places. It's also not completely easy to regulate the signaling power. Okay. So, in reality, designs of cellular systems are fairly complex, and frequently a simulation would be used to represent the terrain, how power is dropping off in different parts of the terrain, and possible places where you can lay out base stations, which are not always going to be in the same place. So, again, we're going to soldier on with this very sort of regular layout, and that's a good sort of starting point, but in reality it's not going to happen. So, the question that we need to determine is how we allocate channels to each of the cells. And so this is done by splitting your total available number of channels into some number of channel sets. And these channel sets don't interfere with each other, so they're completely separate channels. And then reusing the single channel sets at distances far enough apart that they aren't causing a huge amount of interference. Okay. And so what this boils down to is that you end up with clusters of cells, so groups of cells where you've sort of used up all your channel sets, then those clusters have to repeat. Okay. And so one of the first questions is, what size is your cluster going to be so that if you have a certain number of channels, then you can split them over 3 cells, or maybe you split them over 4 cells, 5 cells, 6 cells. And sort of the more splitting you do, the more channel sets you define. Well, that means less channels you have in any single cell, but also the less frequently you have to repeat that. So there are more cells in between you and the next guy using the same channel set. So the first question we're going to look at is this idea of cell clusters and the size of cell clusters and the assignment of channels then. Okay. So in order to talk about this, we define a reuse distance D, and this reuse distance is the minimum distance between the centers of cells using the same channel set. Okay. And so if what we're looking for is our signal to interference ratio, then the two factors that impact this are the size of the cell, and then the reuse distance. And the ratio between the size of the cell is given by a radius and our reuse distance. Okay. So, again, if you keep the size of the cell the same and you increase your reuse distance, you're going to have increased your signal to interference ratio, so the signal will be stronger relative to the interference. But the price you're going to pay then is that your cluster is going to have to be bigger. So again, you'll get less channels per cell.
Okay. So calculating that exactly, again, is a bit, it relies on geometry, so we'll do that in a moment. It's probably easier to see for diamond-shaped cells. For diamond-shaped cells, there's a relationship between the size of the individual cells as given by R. So R is the distance from the center to any side, the perpendicular distance. And our reuse distance d can then be expressed as some function of r. And in particular, d is 2r, so that's the sort of width of a cell. Times the number of intervening cells plus 1. So you have the number of cells in between our two cells of concern, and then if you look at the centers, you're going to have another factor of 2r. Okay. So we can, again, relate r and d to the structure of our layout and the number of intervening cells. We would like to do the same thing for our hexagonal shape. But the problem with that, it's a small problem, but which we'll again just sort of work around, is that the number of intervening cells is not sort of that obvious. And again, the distance you're traveling through any given cell is not sort of regular and fixed as it is in our diamond shape example. Okay. Now, we can deal with that by changing our path and sort of traveling through our cells in a sort of more regular fashion. And we can do this by changing our coordinates. So instead of having this perpendicular xy, we have coordinates that now, again, travel, allow you to travel through the centers of cells. And so the u-axis gives you an up-down travel, and then the v-axis allows you to travel along this diagonal. And now what we see is that we can count, if we're going to sort of from one cell to another, we can find some path. We can count the distance we've traveled in the v-direction, which is, again, going to be some function of number of intervening cells. And again, at its fixed distance here, r, and same in the u direction. So we can now sort of quantify our distance between cells in terms of
number of intervening cells in both the U and V direction. So what we'll have then is we'll know this distance, we'll know this distance, and we'll have to calculate then sort of this straight line distance. Okay. So according to our coordinates, we now have a U direction and a V direction, so we need to indicate the number of cells traveled in the U direction and then the number of cells traveled traversed in the V direction. So for example, this, if A is our zero, is our origin, then if we want to go to G, we're not moving in the U direction at all, so the U coordinate is zero and the V coordinate is one. If we want to go to M, then we're moving minus one in the U direction and then another minus one in the V direction. Okay. So, again, what should be clear is that these U and V directions are calculable. They're just based on the sort of length. You can count them up as a function of the length from the center to an edge. And once you have that U and V direction, well, all you need to do is calculate the straight line, which again should be doable. So, again, if D is our distance from center to edge of a cell, then traversing one unit along either the U or V direction is the same as traveling 2D. And so the distance between, similarly, in the V direction is also the distance traversing 2D. So the distance between sort of along the U direction and the V direction is just sort of, again, the difference in the coordinates times 2D, and again, the difference in coordinates times 2D. Now, typically, the factor that we may be given is R, the distance from center to edge, but again we can just use a bit of geometry to find a relationship between D and R. So again, this is our distance D, this is R, and since this is a hexagon, these are all equilateral triangles, and so this distance is R over 2. And so we have two sides of a right triangle, so we can calculate the hypotenuse. So, we have our values now in terms of R, the maximum
sort of distance from the center to the edge of the cell. And what we would then want to do is calculate our distance, our reuse distance, d.
And this is, again, just more geometry. Okay. And so basically what we observe is that we know what various angles are, and so like 30 degrees. And we can use that to calculate the various ways to calculate D. What I did was essentially I looked at the right triangles. So you can calculate this value by knowing this and the fact that that's 30 degrees. And similarly, you can calculate that value by knowing that that's 60 degrees and these values or that value. And so basically you can work those out. And what you do is you get that your reuse distance now is a function of the radius of your cell, the maximum size of your cell, and then the number of cells traversed in the U and V direction. So how does this all help us? Well, basically, what we need to do now is decide how many cells we put in a cluster. And this is a function of V min and R, again, in a very geometric way. Okay. So V min gives you the distance, R gives you what size the cells are, so if you, between the two of them, you get a figure of how many cells have to essentially intervene between D-mins, between the two reuse factors. Okay. And so once you've picked your cluster size, then this cluster follows the rules that no channel is reused within the cluster, and obviously to maximize usage you want all available channels to be used within the cluster. Okay. And these clusters again have to repeat, they have to tessellate, so they have to provide complete coverage. And we refer to the size of the cluster N as the reuse factor. So essentially that tells you what channels can be used within any given cell. Okay. So before we decide what N is going to be, we'll just have a quick look at what they should look like. And so if you get n equals 7, then you have a cluster of size 7, which is sort of 1 in the center, and then 6 cells around it. And so I'll just make one observation, is that the cluster itself looks somewhat hexagonal. Okay, and so it's sort of not surprising that you can sort of lay everything out regularly. So this is obviously tessellation with n equals 4, not 7. And so again, you can lay everything out. It doesn't look quite as hexagonal, but I'll note that there are actually 6 adjacent clusters to, if you pick any central cluster, there are actually 6 adjacent clusters to it. So in some sense, it's vaguely hexagonal. Okay, this is n equals 3. And again, you have 6 adjacent clusters, so it's vaguely hexagonal. Okay. So now, how do we decide our reuse factor? You know, how many cells are we going to need in the cluster to fully cover our system? And again, we'll start with our diamond shape since it's easier. For our diamond shape, what we see is that our reuse factor is going to determine how many adjacent cells, sorry, not our reuse factor, our reuse distance determines how many intervening cells we have. And for a diamond, again, that number of cells defines the edge of our system. Okay. So our reuse distance is given by 2 times the number of intervening cells times r. From that, we can calculate how many cells there are along any edge of our cluster. And then so the number of cells within a cluster is just k squared. So k now is d over r, over, sorry, d over 2r. And so number of cells is just that squared, or a quarter of d over r squared. So, again, it would be a little bit harder to work that out directly for hexagonal cells. Because, again, because of the way, the geometry is not as straightforward. But what we can do is assume that each cluster is roughly hexagonal in shape. Okay. Now, the area of a hexagon is given by this equation, where we have 3 squared root 3 r squared over 2. And again, r is our maximum distance from center to edge of cell, which would happen in the corners. And so for the cell clusters, we can replace R with D.
So the maximum distance from center to edge is going to be R. Reuse distance now,
and then we get our reuse factor by just observing that we need to have enough cells to cover that entire area. Okay. So, plugging that in, we get N is 1/3 D over R squared, but D itself we've already calculated as a function of R, so N is I squared plus J squared plus IJ. Okay. And so by picking I and J, we're doing two things. We're limiting the values that n can be, so I and j have to be integer numbers, so not every n is possible. And I and j further define the shape of your cluster. So it's, you know, essentially go I in one direction and j in the other. So, one way of assigning channels is in terms of I and J. And so, essentially, if you start with one cell, you can assign that cell a certain channel set, and then move I in the U direction, V in the J, I in the U direction, J in the V direction, and that will give you the next cell at which you can, the next cell with which you can assign the same channel set. Okay. And you can repeat this pattern, and so, you essentially want to move in all plus minus J combinations, so spiraling 60 degrees until you have covered sort of all the adjacent cells. Okay. And if you do that, you'll get a pattern something like this. And again, for each channel here, you have similar allocations. Okay. So, the interesting thing about this so far, or I don't know if it's interesting or strange, is that we've done these layouts without reference to our signal to interference ratio. And so what we've done is that we've said, given a reuse distance and a cell size, then the cluster pattern is fixed. So the number of cells you have in a cluster is fixed. So the next question we have to answer or deal with is, so how do we pick our reuse distance relative to our cell radius so that we get an acceptable signal to interference ratio? Okay. And so, again, what's going to influence our signal to interference ratio is the distance between interfering cells relative to the size of the cell. Okay. Because, again, the size of the cell is going to indicate the minimum amount of power at the receiver, and the reuse distance then will indicate the power of the interference. Okay. So we name the ratio of the reuse distance to the cell radius as the co-channel interference reducing factor, again, because the larger our distance is relative to our cell size, the less interference the system's going to experience. Okay, so to look at an example, here between our small cluster here and our larger system, essentially, we've kept the ratio the same. And again, the ratio has determined how many cells there are in a cluster. And we've said that it doesn't matter if we can increase the size of the cells proportionally, and it's not going to have any impact on our signal-to-interference ratio. Okay. On the other hand, we can increase the reuse distance relative to the size of the cell, the radius of the cell, and again, since this relatively, this signal is traveling sort of a smaller distance relative to the interfering signal now than the signal to interference ratio is reduced. The price we've paid for that is now it takes more cells to cover the area we need to cover, and therefore you're going to end up with less channels per cell. Okay. So now let's calculate our signal to interference ratio. And for any cell, so we'll take this cell in the center as our reference cell, then any other cell using the same channel set potentially interferes with our signal. But again, we observe that we're having this drop-off with at least distance squared. So the biggest contribution to this interference comes from adjacent clusters. Non-adjacent clusters, again, are that much farther away, and with the exponential drop-off, are not going to have large contributions to the interference. So we're going to assume that only cells from adjacent clusters are going to interfere. And so we're further going to assume that our drop-off in signal strength is with some factor gamma. Now, all of our base stations, or everybody, let's just say everybody in the system is transmitting at the same power level. So the signal strength is going to be whatever power level you're transmitting at over R to the gamma. Okay. And that's sort of the minimum signal strength, the signal strength if you're as far away from that base station as possible and still within the cell. The interference, well, all the interfering transmitters are transmitting at the same power level, P. But now, each one of these is a distance dk away from our reference cell, and that's rough, that's center to center, but sort of, if we assume sort of a large enough ratio between them, that's close enough. And so each adjacent cell is contributing a interference factor of P divided by dk to the gamma. Okay. And so, since, again, these P's are assumed to be the same, we're transmitting at the same power level, they drop out of the equation. Now, again, if we assume that only adjacent clusters are going to contribute to this interference level, then for hexagonal systems, we have six adjacent clusters, and they're all at, all of these cells are at the same distance d away from our reference cell, and so we get our signal to interference ratio is r to the minus gamma, and then we have k contributing interference signals, and they're at the level d to the minus gamma. So we get one. Our signal to interference ratio is 1 over k d over r to the gamma, or 1 over k q to the gamma. So again, the higher q is, the farther away. We keep our adjacent, or the farther away we keep our cells using the same signal, then the higher our signal to interference ratio, the better it is. Okay. And so what we get from that is that if we have a desired signal to interference ratio, then that is going to impact on our value d over r. That's going to fix that ratio reuse distance to cell radius. And we know that fixing the reuse distance to the cell radius is then going to fix our reuse factor n, or the number of cells we have in a cluster.
And so what we've done then is we've related our signal-to-interference ratio to the number of cells that we have, that we need in a cluster.
Okay. And so now we observe that our system capacity can be measured as the number of customers we can accommodate per cell, and that's going to be limited by the number of channels available, and the number of channels available is going to be limited by the cluster size. So in general, if we have an overall bandwidth B and each channel requires BS, then we can have at most B over BS channels, and then all of those channels have to be shared out amongst our cluster. Okay. And so now, since the cluster size is regulated by the signal-to-interference ratio, that's, we see how the signal-to-interference ratio then impacts on the capacity of the system. Okay, so to look at an example. So here we have a system with hexagonal cells and gamma equals 2, so our power is dropping as a square of the distance. So we have a target signal to interference ratio, and we want to then determine what layout we need for our system. Okay, and we can, so the first thing we want to do is to determine our cluster size, and then we can look at how that relates to the actual allocation of bandwidth. Okay. So we know how our cluster size relates to our signal to interference ratio, net n has to be greater than 1/3 6SIR times 2 over gamma, which is 2 times SIR, since gamma is 2, that becomes 1, and that's 20. Okay. Now, again, the clusters also have to respect the geometry of hexagonal cells, so we have this constraint that n squared has to be I squared j squared plus ij for some values of I and j. And you can just sort of do a bit of trial and error and work out that the nearest value of n you can get is 21. Okay. Now, additionally, we're given the bandwidth of the system and the signal bandwidth. So by dividing those two, you get the overall number of channels that you can have in the system. And finally, we distribute those channels amongst each of the cells in the cluster, and so we get that we can have at most 9 channels per cell, and that means at simultaneously you can have 9 people talking at once within your system. Okay, now just one word of caution. It's not terribly explicit in this problem. That's a sort of an unfortunate choice of
signal to interference ratio. The SIR in this equation is not in decibels, despite the fact they're both 10. You have to convert, if you're given an SIR in decibels, you have to convert out of decibels to plug into this equation. Again, 10 dB is actually 10 non-dB. So just remember to make the conversion. Okay, so that's what we're going to say about sort of the layout of orthogonal systems, for the moment anyway. Again, what we see is that the layout is determined by the reuse distance relative to the radius of a cell, and the reuse distance relative to the radius of a cell is in turn determined by our desired signal to interference ratio. And then the capacity of the system is determined by sort of how many cells there are in a cluster, and how we can, so which determines how we have to allocate channels within the cell. I had at the start of this segment mentioned that we also have CDMA systems, and for these systems the entire spectrum is being used in all cells. The results for these systems are complicated. I'm going to note them more than anything, just so again you're aware that differences exist. And so basically within a CDMA system, our interference is affected by how good a spreading code you use. So the closer to orthogonal, the less interference you're going to experience. And then within that, you can experience interference from signals within your own cell. So you have a number of channels, so a number of transmissions are NC is possible within the cell, and each of those is going to cause some interference. And then all of the channels in all of the adjacent cells are equally going to lead to interference. So the, and we'll see also that this assumption that everybody is transmitting at the same power may or may not hold for this sort of a system. Okay. And so we can simplify that equation a bit. And so what we do is we assume that we have ideal power control, so that the power level of the received signal and the interfering signal is the same. And so in that case, these terms, PT and PI times the distance, are all the same. And
furthermore,
the ratio, we have a ratio of external to internal power interference, so we can then essentially define our external interference also in terms of what's happening within the cell, and therefore related to this uniform factor. And we just, you know, we lump all that into some factor lambda. So again, that's a lot of stuff to lump into one factor. But we see if we do that, then we can relate the signal to interference ratio to a number of channels. And again, if our capacity, then is the number of channels within the system. So again, a function, although be it much more complex, in a much more complex fashion, of our signal to interference ratio. So basically, I'm just noting that again, because there are different ways of laying out cells, and it would be misleading not to at least mention this. Okay, so again, we've related in both the case of orthogonal systems and CDMA systems the number of channels that we can have per cell to the signal to interference ratio that we need per cell. Okay. Now, one of the issues within an actual system is power control, and in particular for CDMA systems, this becomes quite necessary and critical. Okay, so power management refers to the decision of how much power to use in transmitting a system. And we have to observe that communication is happening in two directions, an uplink direction from mobile station to base station, and a downlink direction from base station to the mobile station or unit. And so a number of issues determine at what power these signals are transmitted. And the first obvious one is that you have to transmit your signals at a high enough level to overcome noise effects, so to give you an adequate signal to noise ratio. Okay. Fading is also an issue within mobile systems, and so what exactly that power level is can be dependent on the frequency at which you're transmitting. So that sort of goes away from this idea that everybody's transmitting at exactly the same power level. Okay. So you need to transmit at a high enough level to overcome noise and fading, but you want to keep it at the minimum level possible in order to save on battery power. Okay. Now, an additional issue arises in CDMA systems in that it's desirable to equalize the received power
from all mobile units to the base station. And so, again, if you think about a base station, some units will be close to it, and some units are far away. And again, they're sharing the spectrum. So if the mobile units transmitted at the same power levels, then at, for instance, if the base station is receiving, so then at the base station, this signal would dominate. Okay, and for the purposes of sort of extracting and decoding, you actually don't want any one signal dominating. Okay. And so what that means is that our mobile units should be transmitting relative to where they are, relative to the base station. Okay. So there's a number of ways to manage the power levels at which the mobile units transmit. You have two classes of power control, open loop and closed loop. And for open loop systems, the mobile units make their own decision as to power levels. They do this by monitoring the signals, sort of control signals from the base station, and assessing the power level of that received signal, and using what's called a channel inversion technique. So, again, since the power level is dropping with some factor of the distance, the guy close in should receive a stronger signal than this guy, and based on the strength of the signal, he will determine how much power to use to transmit his signal. So the guy close in will use less power to transmit his signal than the guy that's farther out. And by regulating the power at which the signal is transmitted at the receiving point, all of the power should hopefully be the same. Okay, for closed loop power control, the base station decides the power at which the signal should be transmitted, and it can do this based on metrics provided by the mobile unit, the received signal strength, the signal to noise ratio, the bit error rate, so it can... Again, since it has more computing power, it can make sort of more complicated decisions. And based on that decision, not only the mobile unit can adjust its power level, but the base station can adjust its transmitting level as well. Okay, so again, this requirement to have sort of all signals coming in at the same power level is for CDMA signals, since there's interference not only externally but within the cells. And so we need to use the channel inversion technique to deal with that problem. Okay. So one issue with that is, so we're looking at trying to sort of regularize transmissions within a single cell. And so that works perfectly within the cell. However, it's possible that if you have fading, then you might end up transmitting a signal at a very high level to overcome fading from, you know, again, between mobile unit and base station. But that high level will then interfere with signals in adjacent cells. Okay, so you've optimized your power transmission within a given cell, but that's messing up what's happening in adjacent cells, because again, for CDMA, you've got the two sources of interference. You've got within your own cell and then in adjacent cells. Okay, so again, the moral of that story is just that it's hard within CDMA systems to find that optimal power level. Okay, so we have two topics left, traffic engineering and then increasing capacity. And so the basic idea of traffic engineering is that we've now got channels allocated to cells. But the question is, how many users can you support within that sort of a system? And basically, we're probably all sitting here with a mobile phone, hopefully all of them off. But if we all tried to make a call at the same time, then it's unlikely that we would all be able to make a call. Okay. However, this doesn't really worry the mobile companies, because they assume that we're not all going to try and make a call at the same time. So the idea behind traffic engineering is to more or less say, well, how many users can we have in a room at the same time and be reasonably assured that when they want to make a call, they're going to be able to make the call. Okay. So if we all try it at once, there's a problem, but the likelihood is we're not all going to try it at once. And so how many can we fit in? Or conversely, if we've got a number of users sitting in a room, how many channels do we have to provide to make it likely they can all make a call? Not likely they can all do it at exactly the same time, but we know that's not how they're going to behave. But likely that if they're following their typical behavior and, you know, making a call every so often, that we will be able to accommodate them. So that's the basic idea of traffic engineering. It's been done forever with your wired telephony networks. We can apply it roughly now to cellular networks with us. It doesn't sort of translate exactly because of mobility, but we'll look at what happens if we sort of forget about mobility and just have a look at this idea of how many users we can have behaving in sort of a typical user way, and how many channels will they need. Now, we're just going to use the results, but with 5 minutes left, I don't think there's enough time to start that topic, so that's where we'll take up next Thursday. So I'll see you guys next Thursday.